of journalism is to question the prevailing wisdom. Question the prevailing wisdom.
Just speak the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth.
All rights reserved and affirmed.
Free of all minds. These are weapons of mass descent.
These are weapons of mass descent.
Welcome to Uprising, a daily digest of independent news analysis, investigation, education, artistic expression, and activism. It's Friday, August 6, 2010, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar.
It just makes me stop and think. Silence is not an option.
A live report from Lebanon about the recent border skirmish with Israel. A new documentary about the Khmer Rouge's killing fields in Cambodia called Enemies of the People. And Howard Zinn's last book, The Bomb. Plus this week's Black Agenda report. This is Uprising. Good morning and welcome to Uprising. A clash on the Israel-Lebanon border left at least two Lebanese soldiers, an Israeli soldier, and a Lebanese reporter dead this past Tuesday, August 3rd. The clash started when Lebanese troops fired at an Israeli army unit that was cutting down trees that could serve as a cover to fighters near the UN-administered border between Lebanon and Israel. The border, referred to as the Blue Line, was drawn after the 2006 war between Israel and Hezbollah in Beirut and has been disputed since. Both sides blamed each other for Tuesday's clash, but on Wednesday, the UN peacekeeping force in southern Lebanon, known as UNIFIL, denied the Lebanese accusation that Israeli troops had crossed into Lebanese territory and confirmed that the Israeli unit had not crossed the Blue Line. Although Israeli Defense Minister Ehud Barak asserted that the clash was not orchestrated by senior figures of the Lebanese army, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said he nonetheless views the Lebanese government as responsible for the clash. An Israeli military official told reporters that Lebanese troops have upped aggression towards Israeli soldiers in past months due to what Israel suspects is a concerted weapons buildup by Hezbollah in southern Lebanon and Hamas in Gaza, as well as increasing Hezbollah influence on the Lebanese army. Hezbollah was not involved in the clash, but leader Hassan Nasrallah warned Israel against any future attack. We go now live to Beirut, Lebanon, to speak with Jackson Allers, who is a journalist, editor, and a filmmaker, and he's also a reporter for Free Speech Radio News. Welcome to Uprising, Jackson.
Thank you, Sonali.
So first, can you give our listeners a little bit of background about the Blue Line? Because essentially this entire clash centered on where the border between Israel and Lebanon is.
The Blue Line is a line that was drawn after the unilateral Israeli withdrawal from southern Lebanon, which it had occupied for 18 years. And the problem, I think, in this last incident or this recent incident that we're talking about in regards to the Blue Line is that the Blue Line is a sort of nebulous description for a line that was demarcated from two previous eras, French Mandate Lebanon and British Mandate Palestine. From the Lebanese point of view, they see the Israeli side as having a what is called the technical fence, or a mass of barbed wire and electrified wires that runs along this so-called Blue Line. What has to be understood about this, and where the sort of confusion about this Blue Line almost led to full-scale conflict between the two countries on Tuesday, is the fact that along this Blue Line, where those fences were put up by the Israelis, they're oftentimes in what is considered disputed territory along this line, and there are pockets where the fence and the actual line are meters apart at some points, and at other times hundreds of meters apart. In this case, what was happening was technically the Israelis were in their territory, or in this disputed area that they call enclaves, that the Israelis have called enclaves. They went in there, and according to all sources on the ground here and what I'm hearing from Arab and Israeli media, they essentially came into that enclave area. The Lebanese armed forces were confused as to where the border demarcation was, and I think this is a much larger point to what has happened, but they came in and literally were going to knock down some trees, prune some trees, so that they could put up a remote camera location. In doing so, as the crane was moving across, this is what I've been told from reporters here and other people that were there, that as that happened, that's when this incident went down. So the blue line is a disputed line. It's a line that essentially now, because of this incident, unfortunately, five people had to die for what has been a long-standing problem, at least since 2000 and really before, where borders are the flashpoint to a lot of problems that might be happening, but yet no one in the international community seems to be willing to step up to the plate, neither the UN nor the UN Security Council, nor Lebanon, nor Syria, which is also a player in this process, nor Israel, to actually demarcate that border line correctly.
And so is there any truth to the assertions by the Israeli government that there's increasing aggression in southern Lebanon by and a weapons buildup by Hezbollah, and that the Lebanese army is being influenced by Hezbollah?
I mean, I think this is the major, I think for me, this points to the major misinformation about the entire situation regarding the concept of Hezbollah within the Lebanese sovereign borders and their role within this. They're a legitimate part of the government. That has to be understood first and foremost. Is there a buildup by Hezbollah in the arms race between Hezbollah and their need to justify defense of the South from Lebanese invasion? Yes, there has been a buildup. There's absolutely no doubt about that. They have been violating UN Security Council Resolution 1701 to build up the arms in the South to be what they say, which is their whole reason for existence, the resistance of the South from aggressors, because in the post-Civil War era, there's not been a military structure. The Lebanese armed forces are incapable completely of defending the nation from attack. So, yes, there's a buildup by arms by Hezbollah, but the real issue and the issue that neither the U.S. State Department nor the European Union powers or anyone seems to be willing to wrestle with is the idea that Hezbollah is a legitimate part of the government. The resistance is legitimized by even the opposition to Hezbollah within the government that says, since we feel strongly that we are a sovereign nation, we have a right to defend ourselves, and we therefore give our defense to those who can resist. In this case, it's Hezbollah. And so, you know, this is a bit of a rhetorical misnomer that the West and Israel and those who support Israel and its defense of itself often utilized to draw away from the fact that there is no viable military structure, state military structure, that could handle an invasion of any sort. And Hezbollah is there because of they basically filled the vacuum that existed since the end of the 1975 to 1990 Civil War. Has the Shia influence in the Lebanese army and the increasing influence of the Shia population or demographic within the army structure is indeed growing. But that's the result of population demographics and the need for Lebanese youth to find viable ways to deal with unemployment and all of these other things, much like it would be in the United States. And so, yeah, it is growing. And yes, there is a growing sympathy for Hezbollah within the army structure. But the idea is that another thing that people don't want to talk about is if Hezbollah is going to cease to exist in the way that it currently does, where it is an outside player within the system of Lebanon that acts on its own militarily, if that's going to change, which is the big discussion in Lebanese politics, besides the tribunal that's coming up and all of this, is the idea of how to incorporate Hezbollah's military ability into a state structure in ways that are natural and organic and cease to need this separate resistance force. That's the thing that the U.S. State Department, or Israel, or all of the people that are sort of saber rattling in the region, don't understand that if this doesn't happen, there's never going to be peace. It's a requirement for Hezbollah to essentially incorporate itself into the military structure, and that's one of the major issues in Lebanese politics.
I'm speaking with Jackson Allers. He is a journalist, an editor, and a filmmaker based in Beirut, Lebanon. And he's also a reporter for Free Speech Radio News. We're talking about the clash between Israeli and Lebanese soldiers earlier this week over a border dispute. And I want to ask you a little bit more about this tribunal that's coming up. But first, where do you think this all will head? A number of countries, including the United and as well as the United Nations, expressed great concern this week about this skirmish, just given that about 4 years ago there was an incredibly fierce war that Israel started with Lebanon, and that lasted a month and really destroyed so much of Lebanon's rebuilt infrastructure. There are fears that this could be the start of another war. Are those fears overblown?
You know, that's a tough question to ask a reporter that's actually based in the place that the world seems to have its attention to and wants to postulate about whether there will be war or whether there won't be war. You know, I can say, as a reporter living here and having gone through the 2006 war and reported for Free Speech Radio News and Democracy Now! And other Pacifica related news institutions, that I certainly hope that there's not going to be a war, because what I saw, no one should see. And what happened in regards to me being an American citizen in Lebanon, watching this process and seeing American munitions entirely destroy the infrastructure of Lebanon, particularly in the south, you know, the rumors of war, there's a heightened sense of war. You know, Hezbollah is fighting for its own identity. If it's a resistance, doesn't it need to resist to exist? Of course, that's an existential question that Hezbollah is having to ask itself as a resistance force. But I don't think that anyone in the end benefits hugely from war in this case, except for maybe weapons manufacturers, which is always the case. But Hezbollah is rooted in a Lebanese political structure, and they would have to be very, very careful with how they went to war or instigated war to have continued support, even from their own Shia population in the south, who overwhelmingly support Hezbollah because they give them social services, they give them things that the state can't give them. But that doesn't mean that this is some blind Shia Muslim Arab population in the south that just they often support things as anyone else would, as a result of what is being given them in the way of infrastructure. So, I mean, I think in this respect, I think what we have to talk about in the heightened sense of war, people play into this concept of warfare all of the time, and I think that the idea is that what the ICG, the International Crisis Group, is saying is that if there is a war, it's going to be more violent than even in 2006. For those that were here and during that time, that's just an unbelievable thought. But I have to say that if there is war, the likelihood that war will happen are a result of simple things, or not so simple things, as border demarcation and how to define operations along these border lines. Other things that play into this, Iran and Israel, of course, and the back and forth of their nuclear aspirations, or actual nuclear, let's say in Israel's case, nuclear ability. That plays in as well. You have the Hamas situation in the south. There's so much going on at the same time. In regards to Syria as well, you have Syria as a major player that can't be denied in this process, regardless of the problems that Lebanon and Syria might have had in the past. So heightened sense of war, there's a lot of international attention on what's going on right now. The Gaza flotilla really was a bad PR move, besides the tragedy of the situation from the Israeli perspective. There's an international investigation being sought right now that Israel's complied with. So there's a lot of factors to this idea of a heightened sense of war. I think that there's too much, let's say, it's too heightened at the moment for people to go into this. It would be highly strategic in ways that I'm unwilling to see, or most of the analysts are unwilling to see. But I do see nonsense reported in places like the Asia Times and other sources where they quote so-called security analysts like Stratfor, who apparently have these sources in the Lebanese military that you know, these are the people that are predicting war, but it's also their business to predict war, these analysts. And I like to play into the idea that Lebanon is going through a bit of a peaceful time right now, and it's only through these periods that Lebanon can actually deal with its problems. And I think that the Lebanese are a bit fatigued of war. I don't know about Hezbollah. They seem pretty geared up for resistance. And they are ready. If Israel does come through, they are ready. Make no bones about that. They are ready to defend this country.
Jackson, finally, let's talk about the tribunal that the United Nations set up alongside the Lebanese government to investigate the 2005 assassination of Prime Minister Rafiq Hariri. What do you think are some of the most important points that listeners here need to know about that tribunal in terms of what it might say about the internal dynamics, political dynamics of Lebanon?
Well, the tribunal is you know, everyone wants to especially the international community, would like to make believe as if the tribunal is this neutral political process, that it's more of a legal process. It has more to do with the legal definitions of international law and the prosecution of people who have violated international law. But the idea that this isn't a political thing is pretty absurd, as it was in the Balkan tribunals, as it was in the Liberian tribunal, as it was with the Laotian tribunal. I mean, you have a Cambodian tribunal. You have essentially, this is a very political tribunal. Domestically, what it means is really rooting out some of the demons of the past, because nothing happens in Lebanon without someone knowing about it. It's just in the case of the assassination of former Minister Rafiq Hariri in 2005, early 2005, which incidentally killed also 22 other people, rarely mentioned in the news. The idea with this is that if Syria is implicated, if Hezbollah is implicated, as is being hinted at, Then you know, what does that mean? Well, I mean, it means justice, first of all, if that can happen in a neutral manner. But I really don't see that happening. I do see political agendas at play. Hezbollah has their Secretary General Saeed Hassan Nasrallah has said that on Monday he is going to reveal that this is indeed an Israeli
right.
This was an Israeli assassination plot, and I have to say that Nasrallah, you can say many things about the man, but throughout the Arab world, no one would call him a liar. He's not one of the type of people that blusters meaninglessly or just in politically, as a political rhetoric, as is the case throughout the Arab world. No, he's much more of a leader that says what he means and means what he says. And I'm very anxious to see what happens on Monday, because the implications domestically that Hezbollah could have been involved, or offshoots of Hezbollah representatives could have been involved in the assassination. The theory posture that is back in the day in 2006-2007 was that Hezbollah might have known about it and didn't do anything to stop the assassination, but that they weren't generally responsible for it. So there's a lot that's going to come out through this process. Will it mean another civil war, as all of the doomsayers are trying to predict? That's playing into this warmongering analysis. Lebanon is prone to violence, but right now I think that being on the ground here, there is a fatigue. Things will certainly be more prone to happen here domestically if other issues of infrastructure, the need to get Palestinian rights in this country, the situation with the economy, and how the recent survey came out that said that Lebanese, a great majority of a huge percentage of Lebanese are living at $4 a day. An even greater percentage of that are at $2.40 a day. I mean, these are things that clearly can lead to unrest.
Well, Jackson Allers, unfortunately, we're out of time. I want to thank you very much for joining us today. Jackson Allers is a journalist, editor, and filmmaker based in Beirut, Lebanon, where we had been speaking to him live from there. He's also a reporter for Free Speech Radio News, and you can read more of his writing on his website at jacksonallers.wordpress.com. That's Jackson, Allers.wordpress.com. He is a U.S. citizen and a reporter based in Lebanon. This is Uprising. Up next is the Black Agenda Report, and then we'll hear a recording of Howard Zinn on the 65th anniversary of the bombing of Hiroshima, which is today. We'll also go live to Japan. And near the end of the show, we'll hear from two filmmakers who made a new documentary about Cambodia called Enemies of the People. Stay tuned. Glenn Ford is a writer and radio commentator and the executive editor of the Black Agenda Report. This week's commentary is about Representative Maxine Waters.
In a society in which government policy now dictates that some enterprises are too big to fail, it is obscene that Los Angeles Black Congresswoman Maxine Waters faces political ruin because she championed Black-owned banks. The principles most valued by civilized human beings, including helping the little guy, are turned upside down when huge corporations dominate every aspect of national life, as is the case in the United States. In today's corporate moral madhouse, billion-dollar bailouts are reserved for the filthy rich and their huge predatory corporations, while smaller enterprises must sink or swim on their own. If someone tries to balance the scales even a little bit, there is hell to pay, as Congresswoman Waters has discovered. Waters faces probable congressional trial on ethics charges for arranging a meeting between black bankers and officials of the Bush Treasury Department back in 2008. Waters has long sat on the House Financial Services Committee, which handles banking legislation. For decades, Waters has been a strong advocate of minority business. She arranged a sit-down between Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson and representatives of the National Bankers Association, the trade group for the nation's black-owned banks. Paulson, if you remember, was the fellow that panicked Congress when the bottom fell out of Wall Street shortly before the presidential elections, crying that life as we know it would cease to exist if the banks were not bailed out immediately to the tune of $700 billion. Paulson was well-placed to make the case for the big bank bailout, having previously served as CEO of one of the main beneficiaries of the people's largesse, Goldman Sachs. Black banks were in crisis too, but who did they have to call on? Not Paulson, who would make sure that his old comrades in crime at Goldman Sachs made out like the greatest bandits of all time. Not Robert Rubin, Barack Obama's banking guru, who also was a former CEO of Goldman Sachs and later chairman of the Citigroup, another prime recipient of bailout billions. No, the black banks had one reliable friend, Congresswoman Maxine Waters. She succeeded in hooking the Black Bankers Association up with Secretary Paulson. At the meeting, however, only one black bank was represented, one United Bank. Naturally, the bank's chief executive made his own case for a bailout of only $12 million, thousands of times smaller than the bailouts given to Goldman Sachs and Citigroup. Representative Waters was not at the meeting, and Treasury Department officials say that Waters had no influence on the loan to the black bank. The alleged conflict stems from the fact that Congresswoman Waters' husband owned stock in the bank, although he no longer sat on the board. The reality is, Waters' husband could not have sold his stock in 2008, even if he wanted to, because the bank was in danger of going under. Maxine Waters never had enough influence to create a conflict of interest. She had no checkbook, no budget, no real clout. All Waters could do was set up an appointment. Now they're trying to burn her for the crime of giving the little guy an opportunity to plead his own case. The Paulsons and Rubens dispense trillions for their friends on Wall Street, and that is not considered a conflict. But Maxine Waters can't even set up a meeting for a small black bank without putting her career at risk. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford.
Visit www.blackagendareport.com for more information. You're listening to Uprising. I'm your host, Sonali Kohatkar. 65 years ago today, the U.S. military dropped an atomic bomb on the city of Hiroshima in Japan. 140,000 people, mostly civilians, were killed instantly. A second atomic bomb was dropped on Nagasaki 3 days later, instantly killing 70,000 people. At least 130,000 more Japanese died of radiation poisoning within 5 years. Before his death earlier this year, People's historian Howard Zinn wrote about World War II and the events preceding the bombing of Hiroshima in a book being posthumously published by City Lights Books, entitled simply The Bomb. In it, Zinn dissects the idea of a good war, a war between good and evil. He details many instances of U.S. bombings of civilian areas and grapples with the more philosophical question of when a people become culpable for the atrocities perpetrated by their governments. Zinn delves into the evolution of wartime psychology that allowed the United States public to support the bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Putting the events of 65 years ago into context, he writes, "If the word terrorism has a useful meaning, and I believe it does because it marks off an act as intolerable since it involves the indiscriminate use of violence against human beings for some political purpose, then it applies exactly to the bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki." Today we'll hear an excerpt of a talk Howard Zinn gave near the end of his life last November 2009. He gave a talk at Boston University entitled Holy Wars. Here is an excerpt.
World War II, the good war, the best. Fascism. I mean, that's why I enlisted in the Air Force. Fight against fascism. It's a good war. It's a just war. What could be more obvious, they are evil, we are good. And so I became a bombardier in the Air Force. I dropped bombs on Germany, on Hungary, on Czechoslovakia, even on a little town in France 3 weeks before the war was to end, when everybody knew the war was to end, and we didn't need to drop any more bombs, but we dropped bombs. So I began to think about this. I began to think about Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And I had welcomed the bombing of Hiroshima when it took place, because I didn't know. I didn't know what it really meant. We had finished our bombing missions in Europe. We had won the war in Europe. And my crew and I, we flew our plane, the same plane we'd flown missions on. We flew that same plane back across the Atlantic, and we were given a 30-day furlough, and then the idea is we're going to go on to the Pacific because the war against Japan was still going on. And during this 30-day furlough in early August, my wife and I decided, we'd been married just before I went overseas, my wife and I decided we'd take a little vacation in the country, we took a bus to go into the country. At the bus stop, there was a newsstand, and there was a newspaper, and a big headline, "Atomic Bomb Dropped on Hiroshima." Oh, great. Didn't really know what an atomic bomb was, but it was sort of obvious from the headline and so on. It was a big bomb. Well, I had dropped bombs. This was just a bigger bomb. But I had no idea what it meant until I read John Hersey's book on Hiroshima. John Hersey had gone into Hiroshima after the bombing, and he had talked to survivors. Survivors, you can imagine what those survivors looked like. They were kids and old people and women and all sorts of Japanese people, and they were without arms or legs, or they were blinded, or their skin could not be looked at. John Hersey interviewed them and got some idea and reported. He's a great journalist. He reported on what the bombing of Hiroshima was like to the people who were there. And when I read his account, for the first time, I understood, well, this is what bombing does to human beings. This is what my bombs had done to people. So I began, reconsidering all of that, rethinking all of that. Investigated the bombing of Hiroshima, investigated the excuse that was made, if we don't bomb Hiroshima, well, we have to invade Japan and a million people will die. And I investigated all of that, found it was all nonsense. We didn't have to invade Japan in order for Japan to surrender. Our own official investigative team, the Strategic Bombing Survey, which went into Japan right after the war, interviewed all the high Japanese military civilian officials, and the conclusion was Japan was ready to end the war. Maybe not the next week, maybe in 2 months, maybe in 3 months. Oh, no, we can't wait. We don't want to wait. We've got these bombs. We've got to see what they look like. Do you know how many people die because of experimentation with weapons? We're experimenting. We're experimenting on the children of Hiroshima. Let's see what this does. Hey, and also, let's show the Russians. Let's show the Russians we have this bomb. So, yes, I came to the conclusion that war cannot be tolerated. No matter what we're told. And if we think that there are good wars, and that therefore, well, maybe this is a good war, I wanted to examine the so-called good wars, the holy wars, and take a good look at them and think again about the phenomenon of war and come to the conclusion, yes, war cannot be tolerated. No matter what we're told, no matter what tyrant exists, what border has been crossed, what aggression has taken place, it's not that we're going to be passive in the face of tyranny or aggression. No, but we'll find ways other than war to deal with whatever problems we have. Because war is inevitably the indiscriminate, massive killing of huge numbers of people, and children are a good part of those people.
That's the voice of the late Howard Zinn, people's historian, who died in January of this year. This excerpt was from a talk that he gave entitled Holy Wars on November 11th, 2009, just a couple of months before he died. He spoke at Boston University, and he spoke about the bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Today is the 65th anniversary of the bombing of Hiroshima, and for that occasion, City Lights Books has published Howard Zinn's last book, called simply The Bomb. It is available now in bookstores and online as well. You can find out more about The Bomb from City Lights' website at citylights.com. We go now live to Hiroshima, Japan, to speak with Paul Kawika Martin, who is the organizing and political director of Peace Action. Howard Zinn was on the advisory board of Peace Action. Welcome to Uprising, Paul.
Thanks for having me, Smalley.
So today is the day that for the very first time the U.S. ambassador to Japan actually attended the commemoration, the annual commemoration of the bombing of Hiroshima. How significant is that, and how have the people of Japan responded?
I think most of the people of Japan have responded quite positively, and I think it is a significant step to have the highest-ranking official attend the ceremony. But we also have to understand that we have had President Carter, former Secretary of State Jim Baker, even the Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi, have all been to Hiroshima. They just haven't come during the official ceremony. So I do think it's a significant step. But if one wants to be slightly cynical, one could argue that part of it is that the government has been, or people of Japan have been, quite upset about our bases on Okinawa. And so some of this could be placating some of the feelings about having a base in Okinawa, and here's one sort of fig leaf that can be offered that we're going to attend the ceremony.
I want to quote
to tell exactly what's behind it.
I want to quote from the Christian Science Monitor that published a piece today about the ceremony that said that some of Hiroshima's hibakusha and atomic bomb survivors are known, criticized the U.S. ambassador for failing to meet with them, apologize for the bombing, or even offer a floral tribute. How do you view that?
It's interesting. I think that in the statement came from the U.S. specifically said, I think he did end up laying a wreath at the place here. There's called something called a cenotaph, and that's where most people lay a wreath. And in the statement said that we're laying a wreath for the victims of all of World War II. So it certainly is not an apology. I think there are many people in the U.S. who think that this is some sort of an apology. Certainly was not an apology, and it's certainly what some in Japan would like to see is an apology for what happened at Hiroshima. I don't see that happening from the state as long as anytime soon. It's just too much controversy, unfortunately, in the state still. If you look at any kind of polling, you'll see that many people still thought it was the right thing to do, and I think it's just more a little bit of ignorance exactly what was going on, and too many people holding the U.S. kind of in more high regard regarding the bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki and not really understanding what was going on politically at the time.
Well, I wonder if Howard Zinn's book, The Bomb, may go some ways towards increasing awareness about the fact that the so-called good war may not have been so good after all.
I certainly hope so.
Paul, what is also the significance of the attendance of Ban Ki-moon, the Secretary General of the United Nations, at the ceremony?
I think that's actually a little bit more significant. It is the first time a standing UN secretary has been at the commemoration, and he actually spoke at the commemoration. We were fortunate during the Non-Proliferation Treaty Review Conference early this year, peace action along with other international colleagues organized a 100-person conference that was going on at the same time, and he came and gave the keynote at this conference of grassroots activists around the world, in which he said that this was going to be one of his number one goals, is to work on a world free of nuclear weapons. And in a slight jab at President Obama, he said within his lifetime, Obama being slightly famous for a speech saying he would like to work for a world free of nuclear weapons, although he wasn't sure he's able to do it in his lifetime. I think it's very significant that he has said this again, that this is going to be one of his major focus while he's UN secretary. So I think that is a little bit more significant than the U.S. ambassador to Japan visiting.
Well, Paul, also tell us a little bit about Peace Action and its work. I mentioned Howard Zinn was on your advisory board up until his death. What work does Peace Action do to try to work for nuclear disarmament, and why are you in Hiroshima today?
Certainly. Well, for some of your older listeners, you might remember us better as SANE or SANE Freeze, and we're currently founded on the issues of abolishing nuclear weapons by Eleanor Roosevelt and Coretta Scott King, the wife of Martin Luther King. And we expanded our work, and now we work on bringing our troops from Iraq and Afghanistan, thwarting military intervention into Iran, cutting the U.S. military budget, and lastly, still work on abolishing nuclear weapons. And we do that through 100 chapters and affiliates throughout the United States, and it's grassroots activism from protest to civil disobedience to lobbying to actually trying to get more peaceful members of Congress elected. And so one of our major focus right now is the START Treaty, which is up for ratification. And unfortunately, it's a very modest cutting to 20 to 30% that we would have 1,500 strategic warheads each, Russia and the U.S. But the U.S. Senate is so conservative that they're having a hard time making sure that they have the votes. And so we've been working on getting the votes for the START Treaty. And the other thing we've been focused on is letting people know that despite Obama saying he would like to get rid of nuclear weapons or work for that, he's increased the funding for the nuclear weapons labs to $177 billion over 20 years. That's about a 10 or 15% increase in funding the nuclear weapons labs. And so we've been working, lobbying Congress to reduce the amount of money that we're spending on the labs.
And Paul, where can listeners find out more about Peace Action?
Simply go to our website, peaceaction.org. peace-action.org. That's peace-action.org.
And we link to that from our website later today. Paul Kawika-Martin, I want to thank you very much for staying up really late to join us on this phone call. Thanks so much. Best of luck to you.
Thanks again for having me.
Paul Kawika-Martin is the organizing and political director at Peace Action. You can find out more at their website, peace-action.org, who's speaking to us live from Hiroshima, Japan. Today is the 65th anniversary of the U.S. bombing of Hiroshima, and also Howard Zinn's book has just been published. It's his last book published posthumously by City Lights Books. You can find out more about the book at citylights.com. This is Uprising, and we're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll learn about a new documentary called Enemies of the People. Stay tuned.
On Friday, August the 6th at 7 p.m., in honor of the legacy of C. Bernard Jackson, Grand Performances presents an evening cocktail of styles, jazz, funk, breakbeats, and cumbia, with turntablism from Mexican mischief makers Trocaire. Also taking the stage, the rhythmic jazz guitar-driven sounds of Lionel Lewicki and the spiritual jazz of iconic L.A. vocalist Dwight Tribble, with award-winning poet Kamal Daoud. Again, that's this Friday, August the 6th, at downtown LA's California Plaza. For more information, go to kpfk.org. KPFK is a media sponsor.
This is Uprising. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. A former Cambodian prison head under the Khmer Rouge regime was sentenced to 19 years in prison last week on July 26th. The sentence was the first ever given out by the Extraordinary Chambers in the Courts of Cambodia, or ECCC, a hybrid UN-Cambodian government tribunal created 5 years ago to try senior leaders of the Khmer Rouge. The first defendant, Duch, served as head of the infamous Tuol Sleng prison, where up to 20,000 people accused of opposing the Khmer Rouge were tortured and killed. His original sentence was to last 35 years, however, 11 years were subtracted for time already served, and another 5 to compensate for illegal detention in a military prison. The public reaction to the trials has been mostly negative, with many Cambodians concerned that the sentence is not proportionate to the amount of suffering that he was responsible for. An estimated 1.7 million Cambodians were killed under Pol Pot's Khmer Rouge regime, which lasted from 1975 to 1979. The public trial of 3 Khmer Rouge leaders, including the most senior surviving leader, Nguyen Che, is expected to start in 2011. I'm joined on the phone now by 2 filmmakers whose documentary Enemies of the People is a look into what's called the heart of the killing fields in Cambodia, Rob Lemkin and Tet Sambat. Welcome to Uprising, Rob and Tet.
Hello. Hi, Sonali. Yeah, hello.
Thanks so much for joining us. Sambat, you are a journalist based in Cambodia, and the documentary Enemies of the People is based on your work trying to uncover the history of what actually happened and why it happened. Why did you work on this? Why was this so important to you personally?
As you know, many Cambodians were killed during the Khmer Rouge. And those victims also including my family members, so the problem of the people die and kill, this problem that pushed me to go and encourage me to go and to research by myself, yes, to find out the real what behind this killing. Yes.
And you got to know and spent 10 years getting to know, befriending, and interviewing Nguyen Che, who was known as Brother Number 2, second only to Pol Pot, the most senior surviving leader of the Khmer Rouge. Tell us a little bit about Nguyen Che. Who is this man, and how did you get him to trust you?
Yeah, Brother Number 2, Nguyen Che, very secret man, even among the Khmer Rouge, he also, yes, keep low profile. Even they know he's the second man, but maybe they thought that he's not power, but actually he was powerful man, and he's the main person who created Cambodian communism. Yes, not Pol Pot. I can say that the main person is Nguyen Chia, who created Cambodian communism, and the person who created and selects the top main Khmer Rouge cadre. So after I found out information about he's the main person in the Khmer Rouge, that's why I try to get close to him. But as you know, I try to talk to him for 3 years, and still I did not get anything yet. So as you know, Nguyen Chia, he's always educate people. He always use propaganda to attract people, and he know how the way to persuade the people. So that's why he takes many years, many time for me and to trust me. So he had experience in the past. That's why he took me many years, take me around, and then. But however, I still try. I patient, yes, and just go again every weekend, yes, to see him, and then I hope that one day he would tell me at last, yeah, it's true.
Tet Sambat is a journalist. We're speaking to him from Cambodia, and he has been working on uncovering the history of the Khmer Rouge's killings. 1.7 million Cambodians killed, and his work is captured in a documentary called Enemies of the People. Also with me is the filmmaker Rob Lemkin. Rob, tell our listeners a little bit about where the killing happened and what were these killing fields that you've portrayed very visually in your documentary.
Yeah, well, the killing happened all over the country. The film that we made with Sambat and I made, is concentrated in the northwest of the country. And what happened at the time of the Khmer Rouge was that the government or the party, the Communist Party, sealed the borders of the country. So it became a completely secret state. No one could go in. No one really could go out. And what happened in the area that was Cambodia slightly depended on what particular party leaders were in charge in certain places. But the place where Sambat grew up and where his father was killed and his brother was killed as well, of course his mother also died during this time, the place where he grew up is the northwest of Cambodia. And this is the place where there was the most intense political conflict within the party, because of course all of this violence was driven by a political conflict inside the Khmer Rouge. The violence spread out to take in all sorts of extremely innocent, totally innocent people, children, babies, all sorts of people were killed. And this place in the northwest was really the area, I think, outside of Phnom Penh, where probably most people were killed in the country at that time.
And what's remarkable about this film is the way in which Sambat befriended so many of these killers, or several of these killers in particular, also two men who ended up during the film. You see them actually meeting brother number two, Nguyen Chia, who is the senior surviving member of the Khmer Rouge. How significant is Sambat's work in Cambodian history?
I think it's very significant indeed. I think it's quite reasonable to say that it's really the first time that a Cambodian researcher has really gone to this level of detail in being able to uncover what really happened, rather than rely on secondary information or documents. And this is what Sambat has been able to do. He's been able to talk to people in the countryside, because it was a countryside revolution. So much of the information about this very secret time of history and this secret killing and this secret regime all still resides in the countryside. And it's really only someone like Sambat who can talk to people in the countryside with the right kind of spirit. It's only someone like Sambat who can really get this kind of information. And that's what he does over the last 10 years he's been doing, and that's what he's been doing in the film. And the film is certainly significant enough for the court, the United Nations-backed court, to have taken legal steps to use the film in the trial of brother number two, Nguyen Chuea, which will start next year.
Hmm. My guests are Rob Lemkin and Thet Sambat. They're the filmmakers of the documentary Enemies of the People, a remarkable documentary about the killing fields of Cambodia, 1975 to 1979. During those years, 1.7 million Cambodians were killed under Pol Pot's Khmer Rouge regime. Enemies of the People is screening at the Lumley Music Hall at 9036 Wilshire Boulevard in Beverly Hills starting today. And I want to play an excerpt of the documentary for listeners where Thet Sambat interviews one of the killers, who is a person that he works with, ends up working with closely. And in this excerpt, I have to warn listeners, it's a little bit difficult to listen to. We have overdubbed it since it's not in English. One of the killers describes to Sambat how he killed, or what his experience was while doing the killing.
So tell me more about this young woman.
She had a small, thin face. Her face was small but long. Her skin was white. She was pretty. She was a garment weaver. Her skin was better than ours, who worked in the fields. She worked indoors and she looked beautiful. She was in the last batch. We'd killed all of them except her. She grabbed my leg, screaming, "Uncle, please let me live with you." I said, "You can't stay with me." She said, "Please, just let me live with you." I said, "Will you live with me forever?" She said, "Yes, I will." She hugged my knees. Then Ang shouted at me, "What are you waiting for? Hurry up and kill her." Then I started to kill her and pushed her down into the ditch.
That's an excerpt of the documentary Enemies of the People. Thet Sambat, why were these Cambodians killed? Why did Pol Pot and Nguyen Chuea order for people to be killed in Cambodia?
This is a very complicated history. Yes, as Rob Lemkin had mentioned already, that is this internal problem we call political deep shoots among the Khmer Rouge traitors. Between the groups that support Pol Pot and the group who are again fighting Pol Pot. This problem has started very early since 1975. And that's why they are, these two groups, they are fighting each other, and then it caused two innocent people kill and die. And because of this, we have the second film, yes. So the second film, it will be explained to the first film why, what is behind starvation and the killing, yes.
Rob Lemkin, can you explain the relationship between what happened in Cambodia and the U.S. war in Vietnam for our listeners?
Yeah, sure. What happened in 1969 was that the American government started to bomb areas in the east of Cambodia. This was because these areas were being used by the Vietnamese, the North Vietnamese Army, the Vietnamese communists that the American government was fighting at that time. And as that bombing went on, which was went on from 1969 to 1973, Cambodia in that 4 years was bombed more than any country on earth in history, including Japan in the Second World War or any other country. No country has been bombed more than that since. So it was an enormous onslaught. Because of that onslaught, the country became extremely polarized, and the the attraction of the Khmer Rouge was, I think, became greater as a result of the extremes of the situation. What happened then over the course of the 5 years, because from 1970 to 1975 there was effectively a civil war in Cambodia on which the Americans fought on one side against the Khmer Rouge. In 1975, the Khmer Rouge won, and they came into power, and we know what the results of that power were. But it's very clear, it's very important to understand that America, I think none of this really extreme violence might have taken place had it not been for the general conflict that was the Vietnam War. And obviously America was a big part of that, conflict in Indochina.
Rob Lemkin, Tet Sambat, best of luck to the both of you. I want to thank you both very much for joining us today. The documentary
Thank
Enemies of the People is screening at the Lumley Music Hall, 9036 Wilshire Boulevard in Beverly Hills, starting today. You can find out more about the film at enemiesofthepeoplemovie.com. That's enemiesofthepeoplemovie.com. For Sonali, subversive thought for the day, Robert Fulghum once said, "Peace is not something you wish for. It's something you make, something you do, something you are, and something you give away." That's Robert Fulghum. That's Sonali, subversive thought for the day. You've been listening to Uprising. Martina Steiner is our interim assistant producer. Producer Margaret Jo is our intern. Melissa Figueroa is our engineer. Our website is uprisingradio.org. I'm your host and producer, Sonali Kolhatkar. Hope you have a wonderful weekend. Thanks so much for listening. I'll see you Monday at 8.